Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. We are thrilled to have a returnee today because we basically had told him he was going to have to return when we interviewed him last time because he was writing an excellent new book. It's Simon Hall, who previously came on to talk about 1956, and he's back. Alina, what's he going to talk about today?
See, I was so excited for 1956. This is right up your alley. You're super excited about this one. So we're doing a bit of a swapsie at this point. We are going to be talking about 10 years, 10 years, 4 years, 4 years forward from 1956. We're talking about 10 days in Harlem, Fidel Castro, and the making of the 1960s.
Brilliant. So Simon, you've done it again, haven't you? You've done a sweeping snapshot of the world.
Thanks. I've tried to, yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's one of the things that first attracted me to the story, really. Not just that it was a kind of an episode full of kind of excitement and drama and kind of extraordinary capers, but that it offered a way to talk about big themes in history. The Cold War, decolonization, the start of the 60s, the Cuban Revolution, all packed into these 10 days.
Writing this kind of history terrifies me, so I'm so glad you do it and do it so well. I'd never have to. Before we delve into the book, and the 18th of September 1960, can you give us a bit of an overview of what was happening in the world at the time, more specifically the situation in Cuba?
Yeah, I can definitely try to do that. I mean, in a way, kind of everything is kicking off on the kind of global stage. So you have it's one of those moments where the Cold War is becoming increasingly it's having one of its kind of moments, I suppose. The relations between the two superpowers, between the Soviet Union and the United States, are kind of ratcheting up. The previous year, Nikita Khrushchev had visited the U.S. and it had gone pretty well. It'd been a big success. It ended with him meeting with President Eisenhower and at Camp David for talks, which were pretty cordial, and there were, I think, some reasonable hopes that there might be kind of meaningful moves to kind of de-escalate the Cold War. But all that really went to pot a few months later when Gary Powers and his U-2 spy plane were shot down over Soviet airspace, and that really infuriates Khrushchev, and it leads to a real souring of superpower relations. At the same time, in 1960, you have a really dramatic escalation or acceleration of decolonization across Africa. In the autumn of 1960, more than a dozen newly independent African countries join the United Nations. 1960 is the so-called Year of Africa. This is the year of Harold Millen's Winds of Change speech in Cape Town. In Cuba, you have Fidel Castro really cementing the Cuban revolution, and in the process, throwing Cuban American relations into the well, heading them towards the deep freeze, I suppose. So, in 1959, the spring of 1959, Fidel's government had passed a major agricultural reform act, which had challenged the power, the economic power of many of the big American sugar companies. And then, throughout 1960, the new Cuban government continues with quite a radical series of economic reforms, intervening, nationalizing, expropriating, and this has implications for, the really significant American investments in Cuba. I think America has about $1 billion invested in Cuba in 1960, which is about $19 billion in today's money. And Washington is increasingly alarmed by these economic policies, and also by what they view as a kind of authoritarian turn, I suppose. They see that the Cuban government is, it's purging the judiciary, it's bearing down on the free press, it seems to be moving in an authoritarian direction. And so, really, throughout 1960, tensions, relations between the US and Cuba are deteriorating. And there's a really quite animated, quite vicious, quite nasty sort of war of words between the two sides. So as we approach the autumn and the opening of the General Assembly, the kind of mood, the mood music in terms of Cuba and the United States is pretty poor.
So let's stick to this to the subject of Cuba. You've spoken about Fidel Castro. Some of our listeners may quite not know who Fidel Castro is, but he is a major player in your book. It is more or less centered around him. So can you tell us a little bit about him? And you actually compare him to JFK, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I was sort of struck by some of the similarities between the two. So, I mean, they're both young. You know, Fidel is, I think he's 34 in 1960. He's about 10 years younger than John Kennedy. And, you know, both these guys are born into born into privilege, really. I mean, Fidel grew up on a sugar plantation in the east of Cuba in Oriente province, in a kind of grand sort of colonial style mansion. Like JFK, he grew up in the shadow of a sort of domineering father, a kind of the patriarch of the family. Fidel, like Kennedy, was renowned for his oratory, although they have very different styles. One of Kennedy's most famous speeches, his inaugural address in 1961, is just 14 minutes long. It's just over 1,000 words. And, you know, of course, Fidel is renowned for giving speeches that last sort of half the day. So they're very different in that sense. But they're figures who also come to embody the hopes of a generation. They both become kind of icons of the 1960s. So they are sort of familiar. I mean, Fidel is a very different kind of character. He's as a child, he was always kind of rebellious. He was known as El Loco, the crazy one. At one point, he tried to organize the workers on his father's plantation into a union and kind of encourage them to go on strike for better wages. Fidel goes off to the University of Havana in 1945 to study law, but he's almost immediately consumed by the world of student politics, Cuban politics. Politics is his first love, really. And he, you know, gets really stuck into the kind of cut and thrust of student politics in Havana in the 1940s. In 1952, he's planning to run for office. He's planning to run for election to the Cuban parliament in the general election that's scheduled for 1952. But those plans are ruined, really, when General Batista stages a coup, returns to power, and suspends the constitution. And really, from that moment on, Fidel becomes associated with the politics of revolution. So, in 1953, he embarks on a pretty foolhardy attempt to spark a revolution, or at least an uprising, by leading an assault on a military barracks in Santiago, Cuba's second city. It fails. It's a dismal failure. Fidel is captured. Many of his comrades are killed, but he's captured alive, is put on trial, and is sent off to prison. He's released a couple of years later in an amnesty, heads off to exile in Mexico. And then at the end of 1956, he famously returns to Cuba aboard the Granma and begins a kind of guerrilla war against the Batista government, which eventually triumphs in January of 1959. So that's a very sort of potted history of Fidel.
This takes us to the whole theme of your book, doesn't it? Which starts with the 18th of September 1960, and it's the 15th UN General Assembly opens. First of all, what is this gathering of world leaders, and who are the world leaders that we will see at this particular meeting?
Yeah, so the 15th General Assembly is one of those big kind of set piece diplomatic occasions of the post-war period, really. It's one of the most significant general assemblies. And that's largely because of the Year of Africa and the fact that so many newly independent countries are joining the UN at that moment. But it's also become famous because it draws together such a great kind of assembly of world leaders. So, you know, pretty much all the big players are there. The main figure who doesn't go is the French leader Charles de Gaulle, who decides not to go. But everybody else is there pretty much. So you've got Nikita Khrushchev of the Soviet Union. You've got President Eisenhower. The British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan goes. Most of the leaders of Eastern and Central Europe are there. Fidel goes. And then you have these kind of luminaries, I suppose, of the global South. So you have Nehru, Nasser, and Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana who were there. So all of these kind of iconic figures, iconic world leaders representing, you know, the communist bloc, the West, the Western Alliance, and the kind of leading figures of the anti-colonial movement are all there in New York for this 15th General Assembly. So it's a kind of an extraordinary gathering of these world leaders, really.
So, same day, 18th September, Castro arrives in the US. Can you talk us through his departure and the arrival?
Yeah, so, I mean, he sets off from Havana Airport in the morning of Sunday, the 18th. He's kind of waved off by a huge crowd of Cubans, supporters of the revolution. His mother's there to bid him farewell. His brother, Raul, is there, who is... and as Fidel gets onto the plane, he kind of, a richly symbolic gesture, he kind of hands over his gun and his belt of bullets to his brother as a kind of a sign that Raul's going to be kind of holding the fort for him. They set off. The delegation that goes to the UN is huge, as 70 or 80 people in total, and. Yeah, the plane, heads off into the sky, and almost immediately Fidel starts to worry about kind of security precautions. He turns to some of the people around him and says, "Have we arranged for a kind of a Cuban escort to protect us?" And when he's told no, he gets kind of worried that he sort of says, "Well, if I was the Americans, I would shoot us out of the sky, and claim it was an accident." And then he gets startled a bit later on when a couple of U.S. Jets appear nearby, but by that point they're pretty much over U.S. territory, and Fidel kind of figures out that they're not going to shoot the plane down over the United States, so they start to relax. They arrive quite late at Idlewild Airport, which is modern day JFK in Queens, because the weather's foul, so they spend a lot of time kind of circling, trying to decide whether they need to divert. They're eventually allowed to land at Idlewild, and a relatively large crowd of supporters of the Cuban Revolution have assembled at the airport to greet Fidel. The authorities, the NYPD, are really reluctant to allow this kind of show of support. So they kind of force the Cuban plane to taxi far away and only allow a couple of hundred supporters to get nearby. They kind of fence them in behind some chicken wire. And, Fidel and his entourage, they come down the aircraft steps, they get into the waiting motor cars. As Fidel's car passes by the supporters who are kind of fenced in, he orders his driver to stop and tries to exit the vehicle because he wants to go and greet the crowd. And the NYPD at this point, they essentially manhandle him. They shove him back into the car. They force the car to carry on. And that's a kind of a signal, really. It's a very telling, I think, moment, because it really shows, really, that the Americans, they're not happy that Fidel is there. They don't really want him to be there, and they're not really going to roll out the red carpet. In fact, they're going to do the opposite. They're going to go out of their way, really, to make it clear that he's not a guest of the American government. He's only there because of the UN General Assembly. The motorcade, makes its way out of the airport and heads to Manhattan. And again, supporters of the revolution have gathered on the freeways to kind of wave and kind of shout slogans of support. And there's quite a large crowd of supporters that have gathered outside the Shelburne Hotel in Midtown, which is where the Cuban delegation initially stay. So he's met with a pretty sizable crowd of supporters, but they are supporters of the revolution. They're mostly Cuban Americans, or some Dominicans, and some US supporters of the Cuban revolution. But he'd been to New York the year before in the spring of 1959 as part of a wider tour of North America, and then he'd been greeted by huge crowds of Americans of all kinds had turned out in New York when he visited. This time he gets a positive reception, but it's a very kind of particular slice of New York that's turned out to greet him.
Well, I really want to know, how does his arrival compare to Khrushchev?
Yeah, so Khrushchev turns up the next day. He arrives by boat, arrives on a steamliner, the Baltica. And again, the weather's terrible again. So he arrives in the rain. It's a pretty drab affair. because he's been keen to save money, the ship pulls up at a very shabby pier in Lower Manhattan with the roof is leaking. As Khrushchev delivers his remarks, raindrops are falling on his head. It's a very kind of low-key, quite shabby arrival. He has been greeted by some diplomatic dignitaries. The leaders of Czechoslovakia and Poland are there to formally welcome him. But most of the people who are there are protesters. So as the ship approaches New York Harbor, there's a sort of makeshift flotilla of small ships populated mainly by Eastern and Central European exiles who predictably, I suppose, denounced Khrushchev as a murderer, as a man with blood on his hands. And again, you know, when he arrives at I think it's Pier 73 in Lower Manhattan, you know, crowds nearby of Eastern and Central European exiles or you know, Polish and Hungarian Americans are there, jeering, catcalling, whistling. They've got a lot of very kind of vivid kind of posters and banners that predict that portray Khrushchev as a man with blood on his hands. So he gets a very low. It's a reception which is low key and hostile and shabby, I suppose.
I'm gonna have to throw a comment in here because, of course, I would have been one of those protesting out there at Khrushchev's arrival, and I probably wouldn't be surprised if my family was involved in that too. You know, being Polish exiles in the US, but I just find it so mind blowing that you've got. I mean, I don't find it mind blowing actually. That's a total lie. You've got Castro on one hand, these crowds are shouting and happy and celebrating and supporting, and then you've got the total opposite for Khrushchev. I just find that really interesting.
Yeah, and again, it's a big contrast because you know, he'd been in the United States the year before. He'd been in New York, and you know, tens and tens of thousands of New Yorkers had turned out to greet Khrushchev, to see him, to glimpse him. And of course, there have been protests too because of the memory of the Hungarian uprising, and the crushing of that was still very fresh. But he had received a much warmer welcome a year before, and I think it's a testament to the really rapid deterioration in relations that had taken place since the shooting down of the U-2 in May of 1960 that explains that. And you know, for both Khrushchev and Fidel, you know, the U.S. government is clear all along that they're not guests of the U.S. government. They're only in New York under forbearance because of the UN General Assembly. And in fact, the U.S. Authorities place restrictions on both Fidel and Khrushchev, and they basically say that they can't leave Manhattan, allegedly for their own security. So they're kind of, it's kind of made clear that they're unwelcome. And so in a way, it's not surprising that Khrushchev gets such a rough reception. You know, there's no one from the American government there to greet him, for example. There's this Canadian American industrialist, Cyrus Vance, who's one of the few capitalists in America who's keen on some sort of form of peaceful coexistence. And there's a leading UN official who's there. But aside from the Eastern European leaders, it's a kind of hecklers, basically.
But you don't need to leave Manhattan to get to Harlem. 19th September, Castro meets with Malcolm X. But before this historic meeting, Cubans change hotels. What happened?
Yeah, so this is one of the key moments, really. So the Cuban delegation had found it very hard to find accommodation in New York. And you know, a lot of hotels wouldn't take them. They came up with various excuses. They didn't have enough space, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it became quite a diplomatic embarrassment for the United States. So eventually, State Department officials essentially force Edward Spatz, who's the owner of the Shelburne Hotel in Midtown, to take in the Cuban delegation, which he does. He agrees to do it, but he does so very reluctantly, and his reluctance is very public. So he makes these statements that, you know, I don't really want the Cubans here, but I have to take them. You know, I dislike the Cuban Revolution. I'm totally opposed to it. I hate the Cubans, you know, all this kind of stuff. So it's not surprising that their stay at the Shelburne is not particularly, it's not a particularly positive experience. You know, if they were going to leave a sort of, an online review these days, it would have been a one star, maybe a zero star review. They're not made to feel very welcome. And the thing that specifically triggers their departure is when there are all these rumors flying around that the Cubans are, you know, plucking and cooking chickens in their hotel rooms, that they're stubbing out cigars on the carpet, that they're damaging the furniture. And so Spatz demands an additional, I think it's an additional $10,000 security deposit, which offends the Cubans. And then the offense is kind of magnified even more when they present the hotel management with a Cuban bond and they're told, you know, this looks a bit dodgy to us, we're not going to accept it. And at that point, Fidel says, right, we're off. He holds an impromptu press conference at the hotel and tells the assembled journalists that, you know, they've been insulted, they're not going to stick this anymore, that if necessary, they'll sleep in Central Park. He says that, you know, we're a mountain people, we're used to sleeping in the fresh air. And then they head off to the UN headquarters and Fidel meets with Dag Hammarskjöld, the UN Secretary General, and says, well, you know, we can sleep here in the UN if needs be. And eventually they receive an offer from the Hotel Teresa, this kind of landmark, iconic building in the very heart of Harlem that occupies symbolically, I think, the it's at the center of Harlem's political and cultural life. And so, you know, late that night, approaching midnight on the 19th, they rock up at the Hotel Teresa, and they've barely had time to unload the luggage when Malcolm X comes calling, and he's the first of a succession of high profile guests who kind of make the pilgrimage to the Hotel Teresa.
So tell us about that meeting with Malcolm X.
So I mean, it's quite short. It lasts for about half an hour. It takes place in Fidel's hotel suite. There's very little furniture in the room, so the two men basically perch at the edge of the bed. They talk about you know, a range of things. They talk about racial inequality. They talk and the struggle for racial equality and racial justice. This is a kind of key topic because shortly on coming to power in Cuba, just weeks after coming to power in Cuba, Fidel had committed his government to eradicating racial discrimination on the island. And the spring of 1960 in America is seeing a real sort of uptick in the civil rights movement. The lunch counter sit-ins begin in the spring of 1960. So these are this question of racial equality is really, you know, it's in the news at the time. So they talk about racial equality, the struggle for racial justice. They talk about the very warm reception that Fidel has already encountered on moving to Harlem. I mean, word of the Cubans' move to the Teresa breaks very quickly. And by the time Fidel arrives, there are hundreds of people outside the hotel to see him, to cheer him on. They talk about their shared opposition to imperialism. They talk about the crisis that's unfolding in the Congo. I mean, none of these topics they discuss in any great depth. You know, I mean, Malcolm doesn't speak Spanish. Fidel's English is very poor. It's really, I think what's really important about the meeting is less what is said and more the fact that they're meeting in the first place and the fact that they clearly get on really well. So they're kind of they clearly have a really good kind of chemistry. If you see there's some great photos taken of them of the meeting, and the two guys, you know, Fidel and Malcolm, they're kind of beaming, they're smiling, they're clearly getting on really, really, really well. I think on leaving the hotel, Malcolm later said that Fidel was the only white person that he ever really liked, and you get that sense of warmth from the images of the meeting, and the photos are fantastic, and you know, they kind of encapsulate really these two great figures of the 1960s, these two figures who represent, you know, different strands of the kind of revolutionary tradition as it emerges in the 1960s. You know, Fidel, the icon of the anti-imperialist left, and Malcolm, you know, one of the world's most famous black nationalists. And so really it's the fact of the meeting itself which is really critical, I think.
So September the 20th, Castro meets face to face with Khrushchev. What was the relationship like between Cuba and the Soviet Union? And more importantly, what happened at this meeting?
Yeah, so I think that during 1960, at the same time that Cuban-American relations are in decline, Cuba's relationship with the Soviet Union is starting to gain traction, and that's partly because, you know, as Cuba feels that its relationship with the United States is deteriorating, it's looking for new alliances for other countries that it can draw close to, for an economic relationship, but also potentially to offer it some kind of security, and for example to find ways to purchase military equipment and arms. One of Khrushchev's key troubleshooters, Anastas Mikoyan, he visits Cuba, I think in February of 1960, and this is the start really of a kind of gradual sort of closening, I suppose, of this relationship. You know, so that's been happening prior to this first face-to-face meeting between Fidel and Khrushchev. And you know, the Cubans had offered to go down to the Soviet mission on Park Avenue and meet with the Soviets there, but Khrushchev was having none of that. He was determined to go to Harlem, to go to the Teresa. And he wanted to do that for several reasons. One, in order to kind of make a point about American racial discrimination and to put the Soviet Union on the side of the African-American freedom struggle. But also, and he knew that by doing that, it would kind of embarrass the Americans. And he also wanted to go to Harlem as a deliberate show of solidarity with Fidel and the Cuban delegation. So he travels there on Tuesday the 20th. And again, the meeting that takes place in the Teresa in Fidel's hotel suite is short. It lasts for about 30 or 40 minutes. You know, they talk about, you know, so Fidel says, oh, he's really grateful that Khrushchev has come up to, he's really honored that Khrushchev has taken the trouble to come up to Harlem to visit him. And this, you know, this reflects really well on Khrushchev, and also is, you know, a sign of the high regard in which the Cuban Revolution is held. They talk again about the warmth of the reception that the Cubans have had in Harlem. They talk about their opposition to American imperialism. They exchange invitations to visit each other's countries. Fidel goes out of his way to say that the only reason he's come to New York in person to attend the General Assembly is because Khrushchev decided to go in person himself as well. So it's a bit of a sort of a Cuban-Soviet love-in, I suppose. Again, the mood music, the personal chemistry is really positive. The two get on, seem to get on really well. When they emerge from the hotel, you know, they're both smiling. They kind of put on a bit of a show for the media. They engage in a slightly awkward embrace. I mean, Fidel is thin and very tall, and Khrushchev is neither of those things. So the kind of the hug between them is slightly awkward. Khrushchev describes being sort of enveloped by Fidel. But you know, it's the symbolism of that that moment when the two men emerge from the hotel, you know, beaming, embracing. That really, I think, sends out a powerful signal about the relationship, this strong relationship, which is now emerging between Cuba and the Soviet Union.
There's so much we could talk about. I had to be so selective when asking these questions. So I've decided to move on slightly forward about 2 days, on the 22nd of September, because over the next few days, Castro meets with people like the civil rights leader, L. Joseph Overton. There are violent clashes between Castro supporters and opponents as well. People end up being killed. But moving on to the 22nd of September, Eisenhower speaks at the General Assembly and he actually snubs the Cubans. How does Castro react to that?
Yeah, so after Eisenhower's own speech at the General Assembly, he hosts a lunch for the leaders of the delegations from Latin America, but he very deliberately excludes the Cubans from that invitation. So he refuses to invite the Cubans along. to the Waldorf Astoria, the very fancy hotel, the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, where this lunch takes place. And so, you know, Fidel, you know, he's just brilliant at sort of doing kind of public relations on the hoof, really. So he goes back to the Hotel Teresa and he treats the mainly African American employees of the hotel to lunch. He buys them beers, he buys them steaks, and of course he makes sure to invite the press along to take photographs. And he makes a great play out of the fact that he's not at all, you know, insulted by the snub from Eisenhower. And he makes a great thing about how actually he's much happier to be eating lunch among the kind of humble poor people of Harlem than with the US imperialist. So he turns, you know, what has been designed to be a snub into a sort of brilliant kind of PR retort, really. Comes across as the better person, really, you know. I guess has a lot of fun with being not invited to this, you know, official reception.
I could just see Alex doing that.
It sounds like exactly the kind of thing I do. Let's just punk the lot of them. The following day, it's Khrushchev's turn to speak. Does he use this moment to push communist propaganda, and does this strengthen his relationship with Castro?
Well, I mean, it might depend what you mean by communist propaganda. He certainly makes a speech that interprets the world from Moscow's point of view.
Well, Alida wrote these questions, and generally,
yeah, no.
About this period of history in communist propaganda, she means every time a Russian opens their mouth.
Yeah. I mean, he makes a big thing about support for anti-colonialism. You know, and his critics, of course, point out, you know, how can the Soviet Union be against colonialism when it's occupying all of these countries in Eastern and Central Europe? But that's a related point. But yeah, he makes a big thing about welcoming the new African nations, about pledging Moscow support to continuing efforts to, as he puts it, to bury Western colonialism. He calls for peaceful coexistence, but at the same time attacks America's proposals for disarmament as nothing short of organized international espionage. He has a big thing about attacking Dag Hammarskjöld and attacking the way that the UN is organized. He's got this plan to replace the Secretary General with a sort of triumvirate. He wants someone representing the West, someone representing the communist bloc, and someone representing the global South to run the UN instead. So he spends a lot of the speech attacking, at least indirectly, Dag Hammarskjöld. But he also goes out of his way to praise Cuba. He describes Cuba as courageous. He praises the Cuban Revolution, he's very critical of the United States for, as he sees it, for kind of intriguing against the Cuban Revolution, for seeking to undermine the revolution, for threatening it, for behaving in an aggressive way towards the new government in Havana, and is essentially, you know, saying that, you know, the UN needs to be on its guard, I guess, against a possible American attempt to overthrow the government of Fidel Castro. So in terms of his relationship with Fidel and the Soviet Union's relationship with Cuba, you know, he makes a big thing in the speech of praising Cuba and of kind of putting Moscow's backing behind the revolutionary government there.
So finally, on the 26th, after we've had Eisenhower, we've had Khrushchev, it is now Castro's turn to speak. And how is his speech received?
Well, I think it's received in the hall in an increasingly a mood of increasing sort of tiredness. It goes on for 4.5 hours. It's still a record. It hasn't been broken yet by a world leader. So, you know, people start to drift out. Some people drift off as well, just because of the length of the speech. It's a very And it's delivered mostly from memory. He barely has any notes, you know. And at the very start of the speech, he says, you know, don't worry, I'm going to be brief. And then 4.5 hours later, he steps down from the podium. Yeah. You've got that wrong. So the speech has lots of things in it, as you might be able to guess. One of them is a very lengthy sort of history of American imperialism in Latin America. So not just about their treatment of Cuba over the previous century or so, but the whole kind of long and inglorious involvement of the United States in Latin America. And then he goes on to launch a lengthy defense of the Cuban Revolution and its achievements before kind of ending really with an attempt to place the Cuban Revolution on the side of the broader movement against Western imperialism. And one of Castro's most interesting arguments really is that, you know, it's all very well to talk about independence and to give a country a new flag, a national anthem, the sort of paraphernalia of sovereignty. But unless you have economic power, unless you have economic independence, you're going to be beholden to, you know, the United States, basically. And so one of the things he calls for in the speech is for meaningful independence from Western colonialism, not just a kind of token independence, I suppose. In terms of the kind of response to the speech, a lot of the immediate reaction to it in the newspapers and so on focuses on its inordinate length, you know, and kind of makes a bit of a joke of it, you know, Fidel goes on and kind of bores his audience to death. But if you look at what diplomats are saying, but sort of behind the scenes, particularly in the days after the speech, they start to say, well, actually, you know, it went on for too long, of course, but actually many of the delegates from Latin America in private agreed with a lot of what Fidel was saying. And some of the leaders of the new countries from Africa, you know, privately were much more sympathetic to what Fidel was saying about the need for, you know, economic independence, for example. So I think the reaction to the speech is kind of twofold. There's the immediate reaction, which is, you know, this is Fidel who just talks for too long and bores everybody and people kind of, you know, sort of drift off or whatever. And it's just a sort of tirade. And then there's the more reflective, I think, response among people, you know, British diplomats, American diplomats, who are not at all sympathetic towards Fidel's revolution, who nevertheless, on reflection, think, well, actually, you know, the substance of Fidel's speech was actually, you know, reasonably effective and maybe more important than the initial kind of reaction would have suggested.
Okay, so Castro spends the following days trying to ease Cold War tensions. Are his tactics successful? And when?
Alex, I sent you a message.
Okay.
That's the one we changed, sorry.
Okay, so where does Fidel end up on the world stage?
Yeah, so I think that Fidel used this trip deliberately to try to kind of boost the standing, not just of himself as the leader of the Cuban Revolution, but of the status of the Cuban Revolution more widely. And that's one of the main reasons that he goes to New York. I mean, he sees a great opportunity to cause mischief and to cause trouble for the United States. But what he really wants to do is to make a kind of a claim about the significance of the Cuban Revolution. And because this 15th General Assembly is such a big moment in kind of post-war diplomacy, and because it's the year of Africa, and because all of these leaders are going to be there, it offers this sort of unparalleled platform on which to do that. And Fidel is delighted because he uses the trip to meet not just with Nikita Khrushchev, but also with other world leaders. So, you know, NASA goes up to the Hotel Teresa to meet with him. Nehru goes up there. Fidel goes and visits Kwame Nkrumah at the Ghanaian mission shortly before he heads back to Cuba. And he makes sure, you know, on all these occasions that he's seen with these leaders, he's photographed with them. And so, you know, he's kind of mixing it with these great figures. And in doing that, you know, he's making a claim that he's an equal to these icons of the global struggle against Western colonialism. You know, people like Nehru, NASA and Nkrumah, these are the giants really of the what becomes ultimately the non-aligned movement. And so I think, you know, Fidel travels back to Havana. I mean, he travels back on this. The symbolism is everything here, right? He has to travel back on an airplane that's been lent to him by the Soviet Union because his own plane has been impounded temporarily by the American authorities over claims that the nationalized Cuban air company owes creditors in the United States money. So he takes the offer from Khrushchev to fly back on a Soviet jet instead. So he travels back to Havana with the relationship between Cuba and the Soviet Union strengthened by this, you know, these tremendous encounters he has with Khrushchev, but also I think with the sense that he's really succeeded in making a claim, a bigger claim about the Cuban revolution and his own place really among these other leaders of the global South. So from Fidel's point of view, I think the trip to New York was a huge success. And also, of course, he had great fun annoying the hell out of the Americans by, you know, relocating to Harlem and then having this whole circus outside the Hotel Teresa for the majority of his stay there.
Simon, thank you so much for joining us. That was so enlightening. I loved this. You know, we don't get to talk about communism enough on this podcast. Alex has to rein me in half the time, either communism or something. She's like, stop it.
You can't be trusted. She has no balance when it comes to talking about Russia whatsoever. We forgive her. She's Polish. She's got beef.
No, that's fine. Yeah, she's got skin in the game, as they say. And, you know, I mean, there's a great incident later on in the General Assembly when, you know, I think a delegate from the Philippines gives a speech where they say, you know, well, you know, we've heard a lot from the Soviet Union attacking imperialism, but, you know, this is just hypocrisy because you're occupying, you know, Poland and Hungary and so on. And that's when Khrushchev jumps up, goes crazy and starts banging his shoe on the...
not very intimidating individual, is he?
Yeah. But Khrushchev is a great character. I mean, he's good value. You know, he gives these... He's constantly giving these sort of impromptu press conferences from the balcony of the Soviet mission or outside the kind of... they have like a sort of retreat on Long Island that he's able to get permission to go to on one of the weekends. And he makes for great copy. He gives a great, you know, he's a very kind of funny kind of guy, right, personally. So he gives, you know, he's good entertainment in that sense. But he's very unpredictable. So, you know, he can be charm personified in one meeting and then he can be red-faced and bashing his shoe on the desk the next. You never quite know what you're going to get with him, which is one of his reasons why he's such an appealing kind of historical figure to write about, really.
I love about Castro that kind of, right, you've let me in, probably not going to let me in again, you hate my guts, so damn it, I'm going to say what I've got to say even if it lasts all day.
Yeah. And I think he goes back to this the States, back to New York in the 1970s to speak at the UN, but that's really the only opportunity he gets to go because you know, the US are never going to invite him as a visiting guest themselves.
I'm doing Route 66. It'll be fun.
You are? Oh, he wants to. Yeah. Well, him, the irony about Castro, one of the ironies about him is he's a big fan of the United States. I mean, he visited several times, you know, earlier in his life, including going to New York for his honeymoon in 1948. And, you know, he loved baseball. You know, and he always claimed that, you know, he didn't have any gripe with the American people. It was with the American government. I mean, the great sort of what if is, you know, if the Eisenhower administration had been a bit less sort of flat-footed about all of this, whether some kind of, I mean, there's always going to be some conflict with Cuba because of Castro's determination to take a measure of economic control, which would have always challenged American economic interests. But, you know, Eisenhower is just so flat-footed and sort of tin-eared about this. You know, I mean, Macmillan, who we didn't talk about, I mean, he's great in New York, right? So he, everyone else is traveling to the UN by motorcade, and he makes a point of sort of walking there, just with a single detective for protection. And then, you know, when he gets into the General Assembly Hall, he sees NASA, you know, the great sort of humiliator of Britain over Suez, right? And he makes, you know, and he makes a big thing of going over to NASA and shaking him by the hand and being all sort of, you know, old Etonian charm and everything. And you just think, you know, a bit of friendliness might have gone a bit further, really. Mm. But there we are. It didn't. Yeah.
The book is fantastic. We will put it in our online bookshop so people can
thanks.
And
yeah.
support you and support History Hack and not give Amazon any more money, which is good for everybody.
Yeah.
What are you working on next?
Yeah, so I've just started a project. I'm trying to write about three journalists. John Reed, who wrote about the Russian Revolution. Edgar Snow, who wrote about Mao and the Chinese revolutionaries. And Herbert Matthews, who wrote about the Cuban revolution. And it's about and all three of them kind of embarked on extraordinary journeys in order to write about the revolutions and the revolutionaries that they witnessed. So it's partly about their how they secured their kind of scoops, but then also how their reporting of those revolutions kind of framed those events for a Western audience, particularly in the United States. So yeah, it's kind of three revolutionaries, three journalists, three journeys. Yeah, that's the idea. Yeah.
Elena's bouncing up and down like a party. Look at her.
You mentioned Edgar Snow, and I'm dying to do a podcast on Edgar Snow. Like, literally, I'm salivating right now. You need to come back and
then finish the book first, Elena.
Yeah, yeah.
Finish the book, and then I want one just on Edgar Snow. The other two can do one, but I want Edgar Snow.
Yeah, no, I mean, I haven't really started on him yet, but he seems absolutely fascinating. Yeah, an extraordinary kind of character. You know, I think he starts out in advertising and then ends up, you know, in the mountains after the Long March interviewing Mao, and then becomes, you know, I mean, ends up having a tough time during the early Cold War because he's accused of, you know, helping to kind of hand Beijing to the Kremlin, really. But I mean, he seems like a really intriguing kind of character. So I'm looking forward to getting stuck into that side of stuff too. Yeah. But they're all, I mean, all those journalists are, you know, I guess you have to be a kind of great character in order to be able to secure these kind of scoops, really. So they're, and all of them end up writing as kind of interested participants rather than as sort of disinterested observers, really. And all of them get, you know, hounded by the American right for their sort of leftist sympathies, really. So they're, I'm kind of looking forward to getting into that. Yeah.
Brilliant. We'll let you get on.
Yeah, well, I don't think I'm going to do any on it today, but thank you. Yeah.
You can help us at History Hack by joining us via Patreon. It takes quite a lot of effort and a lot of work of quite a big team now to keep us going. And so if you could donate as little as £3 a month, it would be massively appreciated by all of us. There's different levels because Princess Marcus has set it all up with varying rewards and things. So do have a look, do join us. There's an exclusive Facebook group as well, and you can be part of all of it.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hackhistory, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.